I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Qualified immunity has been around for decades, the result of a U.S. Supreme Court decision that protects government officials, including police officers, from being sued unless they violate, quote, clearly established law. The U.S. Senate is negotiating changes to this legal shield for police officers, part of the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. The murder of Floyd last May by then police officer Derek Chauvin has put the spotlight on qualified immunity with calls for reform. Critics say that there is nothing qualified about this doctrine, which has put the police above the law. Supporters argue that getting rid of qualified immunity will bankrupt police and make it harder to recruit. Joining us is Teresa Ravenel, and she's Associate Dean for Faculty Research and Development at Villanova University, where she teaches police conduct, criminal and civil procedure, and joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Nice to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So where did qualified immunity come from? This was established some 50 years ago.
Yes. So it's a question that depends on the time period in which you want to look at. On one level, qualified immunity is an old doctrine that has been around since the common law and was very much part of the conversation in the 1870s when 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, which is sort of the relevant civil rights statute, was enacted. But we really didn't see it reemerge into the conversation until the late 60s. And then the court articulated what was then known as a good faith qualified immunity defense. And the defense has just continued to evolve since the late 60s.
Well, going back to even before qualified immunity, back to the late 19th century, what was the law then? I mean, how were issues of police, let's say police violence, how were they handled?
Part of this is qualified immunity in and of itself is very much a reaction to the legislation that came out of this time period. So when we rewind back to 1870s, where we are is the Reconstruction era. So we're coming out of the Civil War. We have groups of newly freed slaves. We have Northerners that are in the South. And we have a lot of violence between them. This is also the time where there's the emergence of the Ku Klux Klan. There's this question about how newly freed slaves are going to be assimilated. They're attempting to exercise these rights that have just been bestowed upon them, and they're being met with violence and intimidation by the Ku Klux Klan. And so 42 U.S.C. Section 1983 was very much a reaction to this violence. It was actually known as the Ku Klux Klan Act, and it gave citizens the right to bring a civil lawsuit against people acting under cover of state law, so government officials, when they violated the Constitution, essentially. And so it came out of that era. But what was interesting about this is during that same time, there were defenses available at common law. And so as the Supreme Court has been interpreting Section 1983, they essentially have asserted that these defenses that were available came along with the statute itself. So we now have the statute, which gives you a right to sue, and the defenses, which protects government officials.
So where do things stand today? I mean, I understand some of this history and these kind of parallel tracks. So how should we understand what qualified immunity means today?
Qualified immunity today has evolved to the point that in many respects, it acts as an absolute shield. And only those who are truly malicious or completely incompetent are denied qualified immunity. And so much of the criticism of this defense stems from the fact that when we are looking at this within the framework of civil litigation, is that what it suggests is that even if a government official violates the Constitution, and I should add that it's not especially easy to violate the Constitution, but even if they violate the Constitution, they're going to be protected unless the law was clearly established. And one of the challenges and criticisms of this defense is that when they talk about clearly established, the court is insisting that it's a clearly established constitutional right. So if somebody does something that everybody knows is wrong, like stealing, but a court hasn't articulated that stealing in this exact context is a constitutional wrong, that it violates the Fourth Amendment, for example, then the person is entitled to qualified immunity, even though they did something that everyone knows is morally reprehensible.
Because there is no precedent for that. There is no other case that the victim can turn to say, well, you know, the court ruled in this way in a very similar action.
That's exactly right. So in other words, the government official wasn't put on notice that they were violating a constitutional right, even though they knew fully well that what they were doing was wrong. And the way that the doctrine has been interpreted is that it requires notice that this is a constitutional violation. And this is one of the criticisms of the doctrine.
And the burden then is on the plaintiff, right?
That's a complicated question. When we talk about questions of law, there's this idea that you should just be able to sort of point to the law, and that, in fact, everybody who's appearing before the court has an ethical obligation to identify cases that would be what we would call on point. So particularly when it comes to these sort of legal rules, it's not necessarily the plaintiff's burden. Mm-hmm. When we talk about burdens, it really refers to who has to bring forth evidence. And so we often talk about qualified immunity in the sense that the plaintiff has to prove that the defendant isn't entitled to qualified immunity, but that's not entirely correct. The other sort of oddity that I will point out about the defense is that with most defenses, the defendant is the one who bears the burden of persuasion and bringing forth the evidence. This is a difficult sort of way to conceptualize qualified immunity because it would require defendants to prove the negative. So in many ways, qualified immunity doesn't fit into the sort of framework when it comes to burdens of proof and burdens of persuasion that we're accustomed to in the law.
It's so interesting because you've got two justices who are so very different, one Sotomayor, the other Thomas, who have been critical of qualified immunity. What are their arguments against it?
I think that it's interesting that they are both, you know, have criticized qualified immunity as they have, and that both have come to the conclusion that qualified immunity really needs to be revisited, but they have reached this conclusion through such different routes. And I think that that's a reflection of the fact that there's so many different reasons as to why qualified immunity is problematic. So Justice Thomas is known as a textualist, somebody who will read the text of a statute and interpret it very literally. And his challenge with the qualified immunity defense is that when you read the text of 42 U.S.C. section 1983, there's absolutely no mention of qualified immunity on the face of this defense. And he has questioned this idea that, in fact, it was meant to be incorporated along with the statute in 1871. And he has called on the court to revisit this question. At a minimum, there's very good evidence that even if Congress did mean to incorporate qualified immunity, that qualified immunity today looks nothing like it looked like in 1871. So that's his approach. Sotomayor has a much more sort of ends approach. She has looked at the effects of the qualified immunity doctrine and has noted that it has become essentially an absolute shield against liability. And I think it's important to understand it in this broader context that what we're talking about when we talk about qualified immunity is that it's in the context of constitutional violations. So we have government officials who have violated the Constitution, or at least have it's been alleged because the court often won't reach this determination, and they're being protected and not being held accountable. And I think that's part of the reason that the qualified immunity has gotten such traction in recent conversations, because it really epitomizes this idea of absence of accountability.
Can we say the qualified immunity has led to more police brutality? Can we say that?
Critics of qualified immunity most definitely have said that. And I think that, you know, there are very clear examples of cases in which a police officer was sued for a civil rights violation, was protected by qualified immunity, and then went out and engaged in very similar acts that violated the Constitution again. And I think that the question becomes is, what would have happened if they had actually been held liable in the first instance? I think that there's a lot to say that they would have been deterred from doing it in the future. In fact, they might have left the police force because they would have realized that they were open to this sort of liability. Or we could look at this from a more optimistic viewpoint and sort of say that prior to engaging in the conduct, they would pause and ask themselves and question a bit more about the legality of what they were doing and whether it was wise. And so perhaps the first instance never would have occurred. So I think that there's a lot to suggest that more liability would lead to increased deterrence and increased accountability. The other thing that I think we can fold into this conversation, or that's important to fold into this conversation, is when we're talking about police reform. Right now, so much of qualified immunity focuses on individual accountability.
Right.
What, you know, having individual officers be liable for their conduct. But in reality, even if we were to abolish qualified immunity, police officers would not necessarily be held financially accountable. And that's because municipalities almost always indemnify their police officers. And this is true of Philadelphia and cities across the country, that in 99.9% of cases, police officers are indemnified. So they are not actually paying for these damages. And the way
that, so the city pays.
That's exactly right. And the way that this all ties together is arguably, if we were to abolish qualified immunity and the city then became responsible for these damages as they started to accumulate, that would create a real incentive for the city to actually engage in systemic change that truly would have the potential to prevent these types of events from occurring in the first place. And I think that should be our ultimate goal. Our ultimate goal should be preventing constitutional violations.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our guest. That's Teresa Ravenel, and she is Associate Dean for Faculty Research and Development at Villanova University, where she teaches police conduct, civil and criminal procedure. And we asked her to join us on Radio Times to talk about qualified immunity. It's a legal doctrine that has been bandied about in recent months, even last couple of years, related to police conduct. And if you have any questions or comments, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Villanova professor Terry Ravenel on the history of qualified immunity, how it has been used to protect police officers, and why it needs to be changed. Let me ask you, do police officers, though, need some kind of legal protections because they often have to make split-second decisions, matters of life and death? They carry guns. They're allowed to do that openly. Do they need some kind of protections because of just the nature of their job?
I think that's one of the misconceptions about qualified immunity, is that when we think about liability, the first thing that a plaintiff has to establish is that under 1983, that there's actually been a constitutional violation. And so in order to determine that there's been a constitutional violation, there's already been a determination that what they did was wrong, that it was unreasonable, that maybe they had deliberate indifference or they were malicious, depending on what constitutional standard you're talking about. And particularly when it comes to the Fourth Amendment and police conduct and these split-second decisions, all of that has already been baked into the Fourth Amendment analysis. And so courts have already instructed judges to consider the fact that there's a split-second decision. So specifically, when we're talking about the Fourth Amendment allows plenty of room for mistakes, factual mistakes. You believe the person had a gun and they didn't. And so long as that belief was reasonable, you aren't going to have violated the Constitution to begin with. So we don't even have to get to the point of looking at a defense. And so I think that it's really important to understand that when we are at the point of looking at qualified immunity, there, at least theoretically, has already been a determination that the conduct was a constitutional violation.
Is that an argument to essentially get rid of qualified immunity?
I think that it adds to it. I think that we really have to not divorce it from the underlying doctrine and the underlying statute. And that is that, again, we're talking about constitutional violations. It is not an easy thing to violate the Constitution. And so we're talking about behaviors that are very serious and go against sort of the deepest held rules of law and norms and values of our society.
Well, this is being debated, argued, negotiated by senators in the U.S. Senate. I'm curious about whether states, though, have taken a look at this qualified immunity and whether we're seeing kind of a patchwork of reforms or changes when you look around the country.
That's exactly what's happening. One of the things that's really important to recognize about the qualified immunity debate that's happening in Congress is that they're having this debate on a federal level. Part of the beauty of our federal government is that we have both state and federal governments. And in the same way that the federal government offers civil remedies, so do state governments. And so states have civil remedies that they offer to their citizens when there are violations of their state constitutions. And what a lot of states are doing is rethinking their rules surrounding immunities for government officials. And so Colorado was one of the first to come up with really, widespread legislation involving this and a very detailed piece of legislation that a lot of people are keeping an eye on. New Mexico recently has passed legislation. Maryland has had a police reform bill. New York City just passed a bill specific for that municipality dealing with police officials. And so you're exactly right. We're seeing this pop up in all sorts of patchworks. And it'll be interesting to sort of see these little laboratories and how the results that come out of it.
But do we need a kind of a one-size-fit-all federal law on this issue?
I think that's important. I think that for a long time, our approach to police and police reform has been far too localized. I think that we need to think much more broadly about these issues and these rights. One of the things that also happens when we have this localized sort of approach is one of the things we have seen is that police officers will leave one locality when they sort of get in trouble in that locality and simply pick up and move to another where they can sort of start afresh. And so starting to think about things like police databases and use of force throughout the country is really important.
Here's a comment from Carl. He says, it seems to me the most obvious way to address this issue is to have some kind of insurance for police officers covered by their employers. Is that a partial solution?
That is a partial solution. And in fact, Colorado's legislation really brings up this exact idea of insurance. And a lot of scholars and academics and politicians have been talking about this idea of requiring some professional insurance for police officers. I think there come some interesting questions about who's paying for the insurance. One of the arguments that has been made is that police officers who have certain incidents, obviously their rates are going to go up in the same way our car insurance rates go up when we get a ticket, and that they should have to pay anything above the base premium, and that this could literally price some police officers officers who arguably have some yellow flags, if not red flags, flying around them out of the police force. And so that's a really interesting solution.
Which raises a series of questions, and we don't have time for all the answers. But so how do you reform police so that you don't need this kind of qualified immunity, but where you have police officers who are not violating people's rights?
I think the very first thing we have to do is identify the problems. And part of this comes in keeping better data. For years, there was actually not even a national database of the number of people who were killed by police officers.
We had no idea.
No idea. And it was in the summer of 2014 where the Washington Post actually started keeping a database. That's amazing that we don't even know sort of the types of violence that police are using against citizens. We've got to have a better accounting so we can come up with better solutions. We do need a systematic approach. We need to think about this broadly. We need to recognize that this is not about individual bad apples, but it's about a systemic problem that needs to be reformed.
With training, knowing how to diffuse situations, I'm thinking of all the sort of obvious but necessary ways of reforming the police.
That's exactly right. So much of police has been militarized and they've been trained in a way that there's very much, for many, a warrior mentality. And moving back to this guardian mentality, a guardian of rights, approaching citizens as civilians, as colleagues, as friends, as neighbors. Obviously, these are very tense situations that police are called upon to deal with, but not every situation is tense. So many of them are just people who are in some sort of tragedy or crisis, and recognizing that and training them appropriately with the appropriate tools.
We're out of time here. Just one more question. Do you think we are at some kind of a juncture after the death of George Floyd, the murder of George Floyd, because Derek Chauvin was found guilty of murder? Are we at a juncture where we can grapple with these issues?
I hope so. I think we're the closest we've ever been. But I also think that it's important to recognize that what happened to Mr. Floyd, unfortunately, wasn't an anomaly. He wasn't the first person to experience this sort of police violence, and he clearly hasn't been the last. And we need to recognize that police reform is a widespread issue that we need to embrace and tackle.
We have to leave it there. Terry Ravenel, thank you for coming in and joining us today on Radio Time. She is Associate Dean for Faculty Research and Development, Professor of Law at Villanova Law School. Thank you for coming in. Well, black males are more likely to be killed by police than whites, a reality that hasn't changed in recent years, even with body cameras and much more coverage by the media. Black males are also at a higher risk for violence within their communities. In Philadelphia, homicide is the leading cause of death for young black men. Today, we want to explore the impact of this level of traumatic violence on these young men and how to help them cope with their grief, their losses, and rebuild their lives. And we have two guests who have joined us. Jocelyn Smith Lee is Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. She's also founding director of the Centering Black Voices Research Lab. Jocelyn Smith Lee, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're very welcome. And joining us by Skype is John Rich. He's a professor of health management and policy, also director of the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice at Drexel University. Wrote a book back in 2010, Wrong Place, Wrong Time, Trauma and Violence in the Lives of Young Black Men. In fact, he was a guest on Radio Times when that book was first published. And John Rich, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Nice to have you both with us. And let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation as well. And they can, or you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can always call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. I do want to begin by sort of picking up on where I left things off with our first guest, talking about police violence and its impact, especially on young Black men. And then we'll talk more broadly about community violence. But from your perspective, Jocelyn Smith Lee, what has been the impact of police violence on young Black men?
You know, Marty, that's such an important question, and it's one that we are grappling with and working to understand in our work with young Black men, both in East Baltimore, where my work began, and also here in Greensboro, North Carolina. I think for many Americans, white Americans in particular, their first introductions to this phenomena of police violence and police killings happen through these highly publicized incidences that have been covered over the last 10 years, where we've seen this kind of steady drumbeat from 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Ohio to 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Freddie Gray, 25, in Baltimore, Maryland, and as you were just talking about, the murder of George Floyd that we all traumatically witnessed collectively last May.
Right.
But for the Black boys and men that I work with, these introductions to police violence and killing happen early in the life course. So beginning in early childhood, where young boys are witnessing this happen to older males in their community, progressing across through adolescence, where as their bodies begin to mature and change, they find themselves the recipients and victims of that violence. And then in emerging adulthood, losing friends and family members to police violence. I learned this firsthand in doing a broader project that worked to understand how losing loved ones to homicide shaped the health, the well-being, development, and social relationships of young Black men, where I was thinking I primarily hear about exposures to community violence, but in the midst of those conversations, young men were disclosing to me how the police were also perpetrators of that violence in their lives. And it shapes their mental health. It shapes the development of PTSD, although many researchers who study these issues among Black communities know that the P is not really representative right. of a post condition, but of more of a persistent exposure. Depression and anxiety, and it also structures their daily lives. The decision of whether to go outside or not, as a young man I call Chris disclosed to me, wanting to avoid being harassed. And so making the decision to stay indoors, to whether or not they are teaching their children and having conversations with their children about police violence. As Antoine, a young man, says, you know, who will protect us from the protectors? How can I protect myself and my child as I'm navigating this duality of vulnerability to both community and police violence?
Well, let me pick up on that and in a sense, toss that to you, John Rich. And this idea, and even reading through and having interviewed you before and also reading through Jocelyn Smith Lee's research, talking with these young Black men, just the pervasiveness of violence in their lives, whether it's having to do with interactions with the police or being the victim of a gun violence or knowing someone who has been shot, knowing someone who has been killed, the pervasiveness of violence in their life is really, to an outsider like me, just shocking. Help us understand that.
Well, as Dr. Smith Lee has said, young people often suffer in not only physical ways, but in psychological ways from its exposure to trauma. And many of these young people have experienced this simply by virtue of the fact of living in communities where there's a proliferation of firearms and where people in those communities don't really have faith in the police to protect them. And so what we have are young people who are experiencing, on top of the violence that they've experienced directly and in the community, a kind of racial trauma where they feel like just because of who they are as young Black people, they are not only not protected by the police who are there to protect them, but they may be victimized. And in the context of post-traumatic stress, and post-traumatic stress makes people feel hyper aware, hyper unsafe. In that context, and when they believe that the police won't protect them or may victimize them, then the tendency to feel like, well, I've got to protect myself. Hmm. And I think this is something that Dr. Smith Lee has talked about as well. That can sometimes lead young people to to look for weapons to protect themselves. And so we begin to see a cycle of violence that is driven by trauma, but it is driven as much by the contextual conditions, the poverty, the divestment in communities that young people see on a daily basis. And it sends them a message about how the larger society views their worth. And I think this is where the notion of community trauma comes in, because when we have young people who in the collective did not feel safe and feel traumatized, then that becomes a kind of contagious effect on those other people living in communities. And so when we think about communities, we have to think about healing not just individuals, but healing communities and leveraging the strengths in those communities for healing.
And Jocelyn Smith-Lee, picking up on what you both said, I'm thinking about that level of traumatic violence and how that can become normalized and how that can be both desensitizing but also hypersensitizing, the idea of being sort of on guard in order to protect yourself from what feels like impending violence. We have about a minute before our break here, but go ahead.
Absolutely. And as Dr. Rich mentioned, in our work, young people talk about that as staying on point, of never letting their guard down, of always having to be alert and aware, ready to protect yourself from violence that might happen in the community, both from community members, but also from law enforcement. And that wears not only on the mental health of young men, but also if you think about physiologically what that means of having always to be hypervigilant. That is all likely wearing on the internal systems and organ systems of young men, perhaps contributing to lower life expectancy in ways that we haven't fully examined just yet. There's so much for us to learn and explore, but their voices give us an opportunity to gain insight about their lived experience.
Yeah, fight or flight. And I want to hear more about those voices. That's Dr. Jocelyn Smith-Lee, again, Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, Founding Director of the Centering Black Voices Research Lab. Also with us, Dr. John Rich. He's a Professor of Health Management and Policy, Director of the Center for Nonviolence and Social Justice at Drexel University. And we are talking about traumatic violence, especially its impact on young black men. And we want to hear from you. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about the impact of traumatic violence on young black men, helping them cope with some of their losses, their grief, how to rebuild their lives. And again, our guests are Drs. Jocelyn Smith-Lee and Dr. John Rich. Let me go to you, John Rich. And you have been a guest on Radio Times a number of times talking about your work with young people here in Philadelphia, you know, healing hurt people, the idea that hurt people can hurt people. And the importance of intervening at certain times in their life when perhaps they are more vulnerable. I know you have, and you and your organization talk to people when they are in the hospital, and they're in the hospital because they have been shot at, or they have, you know, had to deal with some form of violence, and that's why they are there. What makes this such a critical juncture to try to reach out to these young people?
Well, the moment of injury is one that's very disruptive for young people, even if they have anticipated such injury coming. And when they feel not only the physical wounds and the pain, but they also have these new experiences of nightmares, flashbacks, and they don't have any understanding about what's causing that, that causes even deeper distress. So our first job is to make sure that people are safe when they come in, and to make sure they understand what may happen to them in the days and weeks coming, and that they have access to health care and behavioral health and community assets to help them heal. because we know that that moment is critical and may drive this cycle of violence that we've talked about, particularly for young people who don't have access to care. And this fits within a continuum, though, of thinking about public health approaches where we're working to prevent future violence. And some of that is in that moment in the hospital, but some of it is as well in communities, helping to do workforce development so that young people who have talents and skills can be trained to be interveners themselves, so that they can be a force in community before young people get injured, talking about the stresses and traumas, orienting people to community trauma, and giving them some preventive skills that they can tap into. And so while we're thinking about the moment of injury and the aftermath, we're also thinking about how do we create conditions where healing and thriving are possible for young people, and that the stresses in the day-to-day don't deter them from strong performance in school, strong workforce performance, and living lives that are thriving.
Dr. Smith-Lee, you work with young people, and this is the Centering Black Voices Research Lab, and they tell you about their lives. One of the things, again, that really stood out to me, I think they said generally uniformly they have all lost someone to homicide, or the death is such a pervasive part of their life. I think it was 3 out of 10, something like that. How do you help them sort of be vulnerable, be willing to express their feelings, and to be able to open up to you?
Yes. In addition to the trauma, there's this intersectional experience of grief, where the young Black men I work with disclose losing on average 3 loved ones to homicide, with one young man disclosing losing 10 friends and family members to homicide. And these are young people who were 18 to 24 at the time of those interviews. Those experiences start in early childhood. Thankfully, those were the minority of experiences that were disclosed, but they increased during the school-aged years. But adolescence was really this primary window where young people reported losing their first friend or family member to homicide, but also this clustering experience. So either in back-to-back calendar years or sequential months, losing peers to gun violence. And that's really challenging because before they could even grapple with and process and grieve the loss of one friend or family member, a new experience of homicide was introduced. So we have this kind of complicated and compounding experience of grief, where grief and trauma are becoming these developmental tasks that Black boys and men and their families have to navigate en route to adulthood. And so creating these supported spaces for young people to come. In Baltimore, I partnered with our mental health clinicians at a GED and job readiness training program to facilitate loss and grief groups in the center. And surprisingly, they were one of the most highest and frequently attended groups in the center. And I think that communicated a hunger for a space to begin to process these experiences. You used the word desensitized earlier, and there can be some numbing that happens in response to persistent exposures to trauma, but there's also deep pain and intense emotion that young people, in particular Black boys and men, carry, that if offered the space with folks who are showing up consistently in their lives, I have found that they are in search of such a space to begin to process and heal.
It's such a profound thing, especially for a young person, to deal with grief and loss and death at that level. You mentioned, Jocelyn Smith-Lee, about PTSD, meaning post-traumatic stress disorder. You said there's nothing post about this, not if it's part of your everyday occurrence, or maybe you see a memorial in your neighborhood, or you hear a gunshot at night. That's got to be reminders of this world that you live in.
Absolutely. So we use the language of both grief reminders and trauma triggers. So as young people may be leaving their home in the morning to take their child to the child care center and perhaps pass an intersection where a loved one was murdered, that place becomes a mausoleum of that experience, whether the balloons are still there or not. And some people talk about actually almost the psychological tape that gets roped around sections of the city that they've decided they just don't go there anymore because of the intense reminders. And so what happens if an employer is housed in that section of the city, or what happens if a hospital or a mental health center is present in that space? These are the ways in which exposures to trauma and grief over the lifetime, this accumulation of those experiences, can get in the way of economic mobility even for this group of young people. There's just so much about these experiences that we have overlooked for a long time, but their voices, again, are providing us with key insight and access that can help us to think about what we can do differently.
Well, picking up on that, and to you, John Rich, so what are the kinds of questions that are important that can help a young person feel safe and safe that they can have a conversation with someone that will help them either open up or begin to take stock of their lives?
Well, we often come back to the notion that it's not what's wrong with you, it's what happened to you. And so understanding what's happened in your experiences and how that's affected you in your life. But it's this very question of that there is no post that led us to launch a social media campaign a couple of years ago called Our Words Heal. And it really was driven by the fact that we need to shift the conversation to talking about healing and incorporate the narratives of young people, not just young people, but people in communities about how they heal, why they heal, what healing means. And we've gotten incredible participation on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, as well as a website called WeCanHealFromTrauma.org that's designed to really regard people in community as the experts in healing. Communities of color have been healing in various ways for generations against unspeakable challenges and racism and racial trauma. Well, how do we mobilize that healing and those various different, whether they're faith-based approaches, community, music, arts, all of the strengths and resilience, how do we open that conversation while also acknowledging that we have to resist the forces that have led to this disproportionate poverty, disproportionate lack of health in communities? That's not the fault of communities. That is the way that the structures have been built over years. So how do we engage in this conversation? We have to continue to ask the questions, not only what happened to you, but what has created these circumstances in communities of color and other communities, poor communities, that perpetuate these circumstances, and how do we change them?
Well, and going back to you, Dr. Smith-Lee, and looking at this sort of level of trauma and violence, I've heard a number of young Black men say that they didn't expect to live past their early 20s. I mean, this notion that your life is going to be short and it's going to be difficult. How pervasive is that?
That's something that we've heard in our work as well. And sometimes it gets reduced down to this idea of having a fatalistic perspective, but it's actually really grounded in the lived experience of watching your peers be buried and doing that often. This challenge, this task of constructing your sense of self and future in the context of a peer cohort that is falling victim to violence, both police and community violence. And so that is a very real thing in terms of questioning whether or not you will be able to see past a certain age. It also structures decisions that can be made in your life when you're on this accelerated life course trajectory. But what Dr. Rich is talking about is so important in terms of creating opportunities to heal and to partnering with communities to do that work. One of the things we're working on right now is partnering with some of the young men that we worked with in Baltimore to do a Photo Voice project. And Photo Voice is a community-based participatory approach that leverages photography so that people can see and not just hear, but also see the realities and expose root causes of social conditions like trauma and violence in the lives of young Black men. And so showing us how they heal showing us what it's looked like for them over their lives to navigate such vulnerability and engage policymakers in exhibits. In the context of COVID, they'll largely be digital so that they can come and see and converse with young people so that those who have positions of power, whose budgets and whose policies shape the daily lives of young Black men, can rethink the ways in which that they are investing resources to facilitate healing in the lives of young Black men.
John Rich, I'm thinking about especially your work in Philadelphia. And as I mentioned in the introduction, homicide is the leading cause of death for young Black men in the city. I'm sure it's true for other cities as well. And I'm assuming victims know or largely know of the people who have shot them. So this is something very personal. And how do we factor that in?
Well, it is true that most violence occurs between people who know one another. It happens in the context of arguments, sometimes fueled by alcohol, and sometimes the context is an act of disrespect that sometimes looms large if you don't have other opportunities in your life. So yes, I think that we have to acknowledge that there is this idea that hurt people hurt people. Right. So that there is the more trauma you have in a community, the more likely you are to see despair, and that despair may lead to substance use, and that fear and the trauma may lead to weapons, and that is a toxic mix. And we can't ever talk about this without talking about the role that firearms play here. The fact that presence of firearms in these conflicts leads often to deadly violence. So I think this really pushes us to think about how we can't only think about individuals. We have to think about communities and what the collective experience is for people who are harmed and people who are responsible. That healing does not exempt us from holding people accountable for what they've done, but it also means that we have to intentionally help people heal. That if trauma is driving violence, then healing has got to be one of our major strategies to prevent violence and to help people and communities move forward.
We're almost out of time here. To you, Dr. Smith Lee, and I'm thinking about, again, the work that you have been doing with young people, and this seems like such a sort of hokey, almost obvious question, but just the importance of listening to what they have to say, and I wonder how unusual that is for these young men.
Absolutely. Again, I think it's such an important point to emphasize that young Black men who are often cast as hard-to-reach populations or who are uninterested in engaging, I have found that to be quite the opposite in the work that I've done, that just creating the space is so important. And one young man, Wayne, he talks about it. His voice is in the title of the policing article I wrote in 2019, where he says, you know, that's my number one fear in life and the police. But he also says to me at the end of his interview, that what has been so powerful for him is that I've just taken the time to listen. Mm-hmm. That for him, it's allowed him to flush so much out of his system, things he's been holding on to for so long that no one thought to ask him about or create space for him to tell his story. And that it's been such a refreshing experience for him. And so listening is a very powerful tool, and making sure that we are centering the voices of those who have been marginalized as we start to think about the ways that we reimagine public safety in our communities, and also think about the level of resources necessary to match the need. There are structures in place, although they also need reinforcement to address traumas in other areas, whether it's victims of sexual assault or thinking about our veteran community that we just held up for Memorial Day in particular. But it's also important that we think about the pervasiveness of violence in the lives of young Black men and thinking of resources and structures and systems that can match the need in their lives as well.
Well, we have to leave it there. Dr. Jocelyn Smith Lee, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times. And Dr. John Rich, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Marty. Always a pleasure.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook, and you can always follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, Kelsey Hansen, and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.